We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
The Crisis Next Door, a weekly report on the biggest conflicts around the world, with host Jason Brooks.
Thanks for joining The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. A year ago, Hong Kong citizens took to the streets protesting a bill which would allow China to extradite Hong Kong residents to the mainland. Hong Kong's government eventually pulled the bill, but the protest movement only grew, leading to violent confrontations with the police, with Beijing positioning the PLA on the outskirts of Hong Kong as a reminder to not go too far. Beijing has taken a new step to further quash Hong Kong's pro-democracy movement, introducing new national security laws for Hong Kong to prohibit secession, subversion, and external influence. Joining the Crisis Next Door to talk about what these new laws mean and the future of Hong Kong is James Palmer, deputy editor at Foreign Policy, and the author of The Bloody White Baron, the extraordinary story of the Russian nobleman who became the last Khan of Mongolia, and The Death of Mao, the Tangshan earthquake, and the birth of the new China. James, thank you for joining The Crisis Next Door.
It's grand to be here.
How serious are these new security laws for Hong Kong? Is an end to the one country, two systems rule underway right now?
Very much so. And Hong Kong is already talking about, 2020 being 2047, the year when things were supposed to come to an end and the territory was supposed to be incorporated into the mainland. Effectively, these laws give the authorities the ability to crush pretty much any potential dissidents. They're very all-encompassing, they're very flexible. And they're also a signal that Beijing is not willing to tolerate any more autonomy.
Considering the response we saw last year to the extradition bill, should we expect the same from pro-democracy supporters now? Is the energy still there from 2019?
I think it is. And we saw that already with the June 4th vigil, which was banned for the first time in years, the vigil for the victims of Tiananmen Square. And although it was banned, the crowd still turned out in numbers despite pandemic concerns, despite Hong Kongers have practiced very vigorous social distancing as a rule. And it's really been the only thing keeping a cap on the protests from exploding again has been fear of the pandemic. So as that ebbs, particularly in Hong Kong, and which has been even more successful than China as a whole at containing the virus, you're going to see people back on the streets. You're going to see clashes with police. You're going to see the police feeling empowered to commit more acts of brutality.
Has there been any current crackdown on pro-democracy supporters as they do start to emerge from the pandemic?
Even before the national security law was passed, we've seen arrests of pro-democracy politicians. We've seen the targeting of media that goes after the government, satirical programs being taken off the air over supposed decency concerns, and a really concerted assault in the last 2 or 3 months against not only the protesters, but the parts of Hong Kong society that support them.
The publisher of Hong Kong's pro-democracy newspaper, Apple Daily, described the situation like being under the blade of a guillotine and that there's no halfway, it's falling. It almost feels like it's a fait accompli at this point.
I think it's a fait accompli on the legal side and the government side. You know, the supposed autonomy of the Hong Kong government has been effectively stripped away. You know, the mask is off. But that doesn't mean that it's over. You know, Hong Kongers are an extremely committed people. They're people who strongly believe in their own rights, they're people who strongly believe in their own rights and who have come to cherish and value those rights over time and learned to fight for them. And I think we're going to see huge resistance, not obviously from business, because business is already rolling over to lick the boot, but from young people, from artists, musicians, and even from some of the sort of older, more established Hong Kong legal figures. We might see pretty big pushback within the legal system, as much as they can, until the point when they're told to stop, or when they're when their lives or freedom are threatened themselves.
On an earlier episode of The Crisis Next Door, I talked with Joshua Wong, the Secretary General of DiMasisto, a student-driven pro-democracy movement for Hong Kong, and his belief and passion were incredibly powerful. How critical is that youthful energy for the pro-democracy movement? As you mentioned, you're starting to see some businesses, as you said, lick the boot.
The youth element is huge. And when you look at the numbers, you can see how completely the sense of identity has changed in the last 20 years. So even 10 years. So 10 years ago, something like 30% of Hong Kongers as a whole saw themselves as Chinese. Now, among people under 30, that number is less than 3%. It's low across the board, but for the under 30s, the idea of being Chinese is completely gone, completely unacceptable. And the question is, I think, does that generation stay and fight in Hong Kong, or do we see an exodus of people, especially as the options open up to go to Britain, perhaps to go to the United States and elsewhere? Does the territory retain its kind of life and vitality and keep fighting, or does it kind of go into like a sullen, quiet kind of descent?
It almost feels like this would be that turning point. If you had to, you know, place a bet, do you think that most of the youth will stay in Hong Kong and fight for independence, or do you think that they will seek greener pastures elsewhere in the world where they can exercise their independence?
I think most people will stay. It's very hard to leave home, and it's a lot of them also don't have the kind of class resources that you need to emigrate. Some of them are certainly sort of, you know, middle class, upper middle class, but a lot of these are working class kids, and that's been one of the things that has sort of somewhat changed in the last couple of years too. The protests have extended beyond a core that was originally very, you know, sort of respectable middle class students to the working classes, to others. So to become a sort of much more whole of society movement among young people.
Why do you think that Xi Jinping is so worried about Hong Kong? Does he fear the spread of civil liberties to the mainland? Is he worried about how this will affect Taiwan's desire to remain independent of Chinese control?
I don't think he thinks of it of Taiwan in those terms, because of course every crackdown that China does in Hong Kong makes Taiwan more hostile towards rejoining the mainland. The Hong Kong protests were the only factor in the re-election of Tsai Ing-wen this January, when she won a sweeping victory, having been in a very close race in Taiwan earlier. But they were a big factor. They played a powerful role, and Taiwanese follow Hong Kong very closely. So nor do I think that he's really worried about infection to the mainland. Because to be honest, there's not a lot of connection culturally and socially between Hong Kong and the mainland in ideas at the moment. Even though they share common cultural roots, they to some degree share a language. Of course, lots of mainlanders speak Cantonese, even though there have been efforts to stamp it out in recent years or reduce its public presence. But the sense of difference is very great, and there haven't been strong efforts to link up kind of the two, partially because on the Chinese side, the environment is so shut down, so the range of speech is so small at the moment. So what I think worries him is a couple of things. I think firstly, he worries that open defiance makes him look weak, makes him look like a failure. And the only response that he really has is to try and crush it more, because those are the techniques that have worked on the mainland. Those are the techniques that have become part of the domestic political repertoire. And the other thing is, I think that there's this, as the mainland's crackdown on speech, as the mainland's crackdown on speech has got worse, as the space for political discussion has got smaller and smaller under Xi, this has generated a kind of impetus of its own, whereby Chinese officials are under constant pressure to be more nationalist, to be harder line, because if they're not, even if they don't believe that that's the right technique, even if they think that that's actually counterproductive in terms of relationships with Hong Kong or foreign relations, it's the only way that they can survive politically at home. Because otherwise, say they publish a paper that says, you know, maybe we should back off Hong Kong, an internal paper, you know, like a paper for discussion within the CCP that says, maybe we should back off Hong Kong for like 5 years and give ourselves a little bit of space and just like let it get back to making money. You know, their political rival, their enemy, somebody who wants their job, is going to take the paper and send it to somebody two levels above them and say, look at this traitor, you know, betraying the motherland. So that's created this really dangerous impulse on the mainland where it's really become separated from strategy or geopolitical considerations or what will actually work best for the country and become about individual political survival.
So that being the case, does that mean that Xi is more worried about looking weak in front of his fellow Chinese Communist Party members instead of appearing weak in front of the Chinese population?
I think it's a mix. Yeah, I think he sees that the two is connected. He's worried about the idea that he would be the one who lost Hong Kong. And that would be part of his legacy. And that's both a public worry and a direct worry of this is something that my enemies within the party could use against me. Because Xi's own power is very fragile. The power of all autocrats to some degree is fragile, but Xi has turned a system that was once a group system, a consensus system at the top, meaning consensus among, you know, like a few hundred elite members of the Communist Party, not democracy, and turn it into one-man rule. And that's a very fragile situation because all that takes is a push under the right circumstances for the party to turn against him and to flip the message. I think we've seen this effect whereby the virulence of the crackdowns in Tibet and Xinjiang, some of these other territories that are disputed parts of China where the local population does not want to be part of China, where they have a long history of independence, those attitudes that any opposition is terrorism and treachery and foreign influence and black hands undermining the party has really started to seep into even Hong Kong, which is so much more different and so much more open and accessible and visible than those territories.
James, the U.S. responded quickly to Beijing's move with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo saying that Hong Kong could no longer be considered a meaningfully autonomous territory, and there could be a range of U.S. countermeasures, including dropping Hong Kong's special trading status. How big of a deal would that move be, and what can the U.S. do to get Beijing to roll back the new laws?
The truth is, I don't think there's anything that the U.S. can do to get Beijing to roll back the new laws. I think that Chinese domestic politics has become very so disconnected from the sort of geopolitical weight that the forms of influence that the U.S. can bring to bear simply won't override the pressures internally. In fact, giving into them would be seen as a fatal weakness by CCP leaders. So the U.S. can take measures to indicate its displeasure. They can take measures to try and limit China's power. They can provide refuge to Hong Kongers. But I don't think that they can actually force the national security law to be rescinded.
Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam has denied the new security legislation will curtail media freedom, which is guaranteed under Article 27 of the Basic Law, the mini-constitution agreed to by China when it took back control of the former British colony in 1997. Do you believe her?
No, nobody believes that. Not even her. It's a purely cynical statement. Not even her own side believes that. It'll be like Russia. There'll be, in theory, some media freedoms. There may be places still allowed to publish, but the cost of any risky article or publishing dissident writers will start to grow and grow, forcing mainstream publishers, places like the South China Morning Post, to become more and more pro-establishment, a process we've always already seen happening to some degree, and forcing truly independent or dissident publications really to the margins. So it won't be that everybody will be arrested or that publishing something automatically gets you arrested. There'll be enough arrests and enough crackdowns and enough, you know, sudden tax examinations or visa restrictions or this kind of things to make the environment incredibly difficult.
And Hong Kong's legislature passed a law that criminalizes mocking China's national anthem because it's often booed in Hong Kong. How is this going down in the territory? And do you foresee mass challenges to the law? I mean, how can they unrest in an entire arena for booing?
Yeah, I think this is going to be, this was an incredibly foolish move. And again, it's an example of how these sort of domestic shibboleths have overridden practical politics. Because of course, if you tell a football crowd that they can't boo something, they're going to boo it even harder on the principle that you can't arrest anyone, everyone. And the question is, will we see a cycle then whereby Communist Party officials in Beijing see these issues of the national anthem being booed again and demand even stricter action and mass arrests, which prompts more protests, which prompts the national anthem to be booed even more? I mean, it really seems like it's just a downward spiral from here.
You know, considering the pandemic and the economic damage suffered by China this year, is Beijing biting off more than it can chew? I mean, on top of Hong Kong, it's still wrangling over trade with the U.S. and it's embroiled in another standoff with India in a disputed region of Kashmir.
I think it is. And I think that these costs are going to really come back and bite it. You know, the Chinese economy was already looking, well, it was looking like an economy that had outgrown the sort of 30-year like reaping dividends of easy modernization or relatively easy modernization, and was starting to struggle with some really big challenges about how do you move up the value ladder, how do you deal with local debt, or this kind of thing. And instead of having the energy to like make those reforms and focus on those problems, we're now seeing the Chinese state becoming occupied with these squabbles all along its borders. We're seeing it taking on new economic costs by trying to fight trade wars. We're seeing strategies such as Chinese state-backed businesses like Huawei, which, you know, technically a private business, but it, as we all know, in practice, highly backed by the state, getting massive pushback worldwide. And my feeling is that among the Chinese sort of elite, among the rich, there's certainly an awareness of those costs and a frustration with that. When I talked to people, and you know, people who are mostly, you know, small millionaires, let's say, like the Beijing like upper class, but not like the uber rich, but people who went to the US, had family there, did business worldwide, they were very unhappy with Xi even 2 years ago, and I think that there's a degree that unhappiness may only be growing. Now on the other side. Nationalism is a powerful drug, and the idea, you know, well, you know, we might be paying this cost, but we're fighting a war for China's survival against the US. We're fighting a war to make ourselves great again. It's just an economic war. That may be very appealing to a lot of people too.
What do you think the average Chinese opinion is of Hong Kong and what needs to be done with Hong Kong?
It's pretty negative, to be honest. They see Hong Kong as arrogant. They see Hong Kong as ungrateful children. They see the territory as something. They see it as something that has to be crushed and brought back into line. There are, of course, Chinese who sympathize with the Hong Kongers, who see them as holding up rights that have been lost, and even as preserving culture that's been lost to the mainland because of things like traditional characters, the Cantonese language, Chinese religion. But I would say that the majority opinion, is, as much as we can tell, which is always hard, is quite close to that sort of nationalist line at the moment.
As the pandemic starts to ease, James, what's your prediction for the remainder of 2020? Do you expect to see bigger, even possibly more violent protests in Hong Kong than what we saw last year?
I think, yes. I think we're going to see very intense clashes. I think we'll see big shutdowns as the government attempts to prevent the numbers from getting out onto the street. I would expect some kind of flashpoint incident. You know, if the police kill somebody, or if there's a big arrest, that could put lots of people out there in moments. And it's going to just be a very volatile and fraught, not just this year, but for, you know, years, maybe decades to come. Even if stuff goes quiet for a couple of years, it could flare up again at any moment.
We just passed the 31-year anniversary of Tiananmen Square. Do you think that still plays a role in how Beijing handles these protests and possibly keeps it from going further than it might want to?
It's an interesting question. I think that Beijing has a certain reluctance to use force when they know the cameras are watching. Because we've already seen mass violence used against Tibetans, against Uyghur. In 2009, for instance, after the riots in Urumqi, the People's Armed Police entered the city and began shooting pretty much any Uyghur man who was on the street after curfew. But they are very aware that there are cameras in Hong Kong and that the world is watching Hong Kong. And I think that that is a restricting factor. I think that's why they're going to be content to work through police and police brutality rather than actually unleashing sort of paramilitary forces or the PLA.
Well, it's certainly going to be interesting to see what transpires over the coming months, but certainly a fiery situation remains in Hong Kong. James, thank you very much for taking time with us here on The Crisis Next Door.
Thank you for having me.
We've been joined by James Palmer, Deputy Editor at Forum Policy. Thanks for listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. Till next time.
The Crisis Next Door with host Jason Brooks is produced weekly.
If you have any thoughts for Jason, email him at tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com. Again, that's tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.